We live? Hey, we're live. Look at that.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome everybody to the Energy Realities Podcast for Monday. What is today? February 19th, 2024. It's President's Day in the United States, but not in Bulgaria where Irina Slav is. It's not in the UK where Tammy Nemeth is. And it is in Oklahoma where Stu Turley is. Are you in Texas today?
I'm in Dallas today. So
you're in Dallas today. Okay. Well, you're not too far from me in Mansfield, Texas. Here we are. I'm David Blackman, your host for today. I guess I'm the moderator of this deal. We'll see how that goes for me today. Our topic is, can we trust the numbers related to the energy transition? We're kind of concerned about numbers coming out of the IEA mainly, but also I think from the EIA to some extent. Are these agencies that are supposed to be providing the numbers surrounding the energy transition really reliable? And I think it's especially relevant to us this week because the EIA last week celebrated its 50th anniversary, 50 years ago last week. The International Energy Agency was created by, they have something like 140 countries now who are subscribers to it. Supporters of it help fund it. It was initially created to do studies and research and produce accurate data surrounding oil supply and demand globally. Its mission was expanded over the past decade to now branch out into other branches of the energy space and provide accurate data supposedly related to those. And was it Tammy, was it you who circulated the link to a story this morning that the agency's mission was expanded, seems to have been expanded, at their celebratory meeting last week?
Yeah, I subscribe to the International Energy Agency's newsletter. And of course, because of the big ministerial last week celebrating the 50th, and they do this every year where the ministers and whatnot get together and talk about what the IEA's mandate ought to be or whatever, which I find interesting that they keep updating the mandate. It's like once you have a mandate, you think it would sort of stay the same. But what I found so interesting was that the mandate now, which the energy ministers had agreed on, is that they were going to be, what was the word? Was it enforcing the outcome of COP28? And I thought, well, right. What does that mean? Guiding the implementation. What does that mean? Because that's basically, is that saying that an international organization is now going to put each nation's feet to the fire to hold up whatever promises they've made at various international meetings? I mean, that seems to be a bit of an abrogation of sovereignty by the nations if they're permitting that. But it was unclear to me what it meant to oversee the implementation of these promises. I don't know. What do you guys think? What does that mean? I just saw that today and I thought, I don't know.
To enforce this implementation of COP28, how does it do that?
I don't know.
That's why it seems so strange that this was like the number one thing they identified as being the reevaluation of their mandate. And so does that mean all of the signatories to the IEA, all the different nations, are somehow giving up some authority to the IEA to help implement? I don't know.
One of the things they agreed to at COP28, let's remember there was an agreement, not among all the attending nations, but some of them, to get rid of any unabated coal plants that still remain within their countries, phase those out. What power, what authority does the International Energy Agency have to, say, as a specific example, enforce that agreement? I can't think of anything. It's unimaginable to me that they have any actual authority to do that.
They don't. I don't think they do. And what is unabated coal? They really love
I know.
What is abated coal and what is unabated, as opposed to, you know, what's the difference between abated and unabated?
Right. Because, I mean, if a plant's truly unabated, it means it doesn't have any scrubbers on it taking out any of the pollution, right? Which there hasn't been a coal plant built without scrubbers since the 1970s. So, I mean, I can't believe such a plant even exists to begin with, but I think what they were talking about specifically in that agreement was any new coal plant that doesn't have carbon capture technology associated with it, which seems kind of ironic to me, since so many of the climate alarmists don't think carbon capture works.
Well, they're actively against it.
Yeah.
They're actively against it for sure. Because, I mean, in Saskatchewan, there's one of the coal power plants was the basic example for testing out the technology of carbon capture. And, you know, after 10 years or so of trying to figure out all the bugs and everything, they finally have it. So it's about, I think, 85 to 90% efficient, and it captures 85 to 90% of the emissions. And they use it for enhanced oil recovery, which drives the environmentalists crazy. They do store some of it permanently, but most of it goes to EOR. So the technology is getting there, but the environmentalists hate it. They hate it because it allows the industry to continue to exist. And I've heard them say that. I've heard different environmental organizations say the whole point is to get rid of the industry. So even with the technology developments, it's like, no, we don't want it anyway, which you have to ask yourself why. Why is that? But
well, that's kind of a new thing. You know, before last year, they wouldn't admit that that was the goal. But starting last year, the activists in that movement became a lot more vocal about what their movement's real goals are. And so we're seeing more and more rhetoric around that, around population decrease as being a real goal, around the fact that their real goal in transportation is to not to convert you to electric vehicles, but to convince you never to drive again, right? And they want to take your cars completely away. And it's been really interesting progression seeing them become so increasingly bold with their rhetoric over the last few years.
Yeah, and ever more radical.
Ever more radical, yes. Stu?
This brings up an interesting oxymoron, other than me, since I'm the moron of the group here.
I'm the oxy. You're the moron, right?
You are. And speaking of oxy, Direct Air Capture, BlackRock, who is the king of ESG hypocrisy investing. I think they invented ESG hypocrisy investing. BlackRock invests $550 million, world's largest direct air capture plant. And when you sit back and take a look at this, it is now a joint venture with Occidental Petroleum, Stratos in Ector County, Texas. And I find it amazing that Occidental is peeling out, as David and I have talked about, and they're going to the ESG direct capture methodology in oil and gas, and available for the Inflation Reduction Act, which Dan Bongino calls the Porculus Bill. And I kind of like the Porculus Bill on this, because it's driving inflation up, and Porculus is one of my favorite words. And hey, shout out to Patrick Devine. But where I'm going yay, Patrick. We love Patrick. And so, as we go through this, this animal will remove a ton of CO2 for $600 to $1,000. But where this actually plays into a big thing is the regulatory actions, legislation through regulatory actions in what they're charging oil and gas companies. Is Oxy going to be the only one immune from these regulatory issues? Could be. And then Warren Buffett just invested, I believe it was $2.7 million or $27 million just recently in Oxy. I need to go fact check myself.
Yeah, Buffett loves Oxy stock and Chevron.
And
this is very funny what you say about the price per ton of CO2 with direct air capture, because you've probably seen the news today that the price per ton of carbon dioxide in Europe has fallen to a 2-year low. Everyone expected it to keep climbing. Yeah, it's fallen to 55 euros per ton when they were expecting and hoping for 100 euros per ton.
Of course, yeah.
So they could fund their transition. But now, and what's really amazing, we are getting so far away from the topic. But anyway.
That's okay.
Oh, no. Hey, David and Irina and Tammy, I want to ask this opinion because we sit back and take a look at the wealth transfer for the green. You got the elites out there telling us that we must enjoy wind farms and solar, which, you know, I'm installing wind and solar at my remote place to get off the grid. But when we sit back and take a look, it's a wealth transfer. Is the carbon capture and carbon tax the next methodology because wind and solar is failing and the investing is failing? Are they now picking this up to try to get back to this? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and carbon pricing is not working, which was what I was going to say. Prices are going lower instead of higher.
Right.
So the money they had lined up, planned to have lined up for the transition is not there because carbon is getting cheaper rather than more expensive.
Patrick says, to supplement David's comment, BlackRock and JP Morgan Chase are thumbing their noses at the ESG requirements, at least some of them. Yeah. But Tammy made a really good point about that. They pulled out of this one ESG banking alliance, right? But there's this whole 100. Other one yeah. that they haven't pulled out of, right, Tammy?
Yeah.
And so what this really means is they're doing that for public relations purposes and nothing is really going to change in terms of their investment philosophy. That's just to try to impress all the Republican attorneys general in the various states in the United States that are going after these banks that for refusing to finance energy projects. And it's really not much more than that. Nothing's going to change in their strategic approach, I don't think. Does anyone have a different view on that?
They are going to lose eventually because JP Morgan is basing its planning. I read a report a few months ago. I can't remember how long it was. This report by JP Morgan was citing data from Ember, the climate NGO.
Uh-huh.
They were treating it as accurate data, which they can use as a foundation for their future investment strategy.
Right.
And if they really decide to stick with this, well, I'm really sorry for them.
Well, I'm really sorry for their customers and clients, you know.
That too.
Yeah.
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 Because in the end, it's people, citizens who suffer. It's not the elites or the policymakers or whatever.
Right.
It's always the
borne most by the poorest.
Consumers always get it in the drive thru, as I always say. And when you get screwed in the drive thru.
Okay, back to the topic. Get away from screwing.
But that was good because Irina mentioned about, you know, JP Morgan using the Ember data. And if we're talking about, you know, what's up with numbers, right? Because what happens when I was thinking about the IEA, for example, have they gone the way of the mainstream media where it's like they become more of a mouthpiece for certain agendas and whatnot, yeah, rather than being a more neutral, analytical body. And I think the Energy Information Administration in the United States has been the most reliable out of all of the different sort of big data groups. Bruegel's pretty good. And you know, I think Rystad used to be good, but some of their stuff coming out, I've kind of been like, well, where's this coming from?
Weird. Rystad and Wood Mackenzie both.
They've
just kind of gone whole hog into, I think, trying to attract clients from the renewable space, and so they.
But they don't have money. Why would they want to attract clients from that space?
I don't know. It just seems. And it's not just those two, it's other companies as well that are in the advisory business. One that is, I think, completely resisted all that is Enverus. And it's, yeah, you know, your point about the EIA, I think, is is really well taken, because you know that, you know, there's been a ton of pressure on them to slant their reporting as well, and they have somehow resisted that in this administration. So good for them.
Yes, but even they made mistakes. Like last year, for several months, they were projecting lower output from the Permian.
Right.
Like three months in a row. Instead, output grew.
Right.
I think they fell into the trap that everyone else fell in, because the rig count was lower, and they thought this automatically means lower output, which was not the case. So it's an honest mistake.
And they buy the siren song that recoveries, you know, from the Mark Papa led crowd in the oil executives, that the Permian's dying, all the good locations have been drilled up, per well recoveries are falling when they're actually rising, and you know, you fall for that and you include it in your assumptions, and you're automatically going to get lower projections that are actually happening, because per well recoveries are actually increasing, not declining.
Yeah. If I can add something to that. So I think one of the other problems with there's one thing to have reported data, you know, this is what the numbers that we're getting directly from producers or nations or so on. And then there's the forward-looking projections.
Yeah.
And it's those forward-looking projections that are problematic in many circumstances. And part of it is the type of modeling that they do. And there's always issues with computer models, depending on what your variables are, what are your inputs, how are you running them, and so on. And that brings me to the point, well, I guess maybe I should wait, but it's about climate scenario analysis.
Yeah, and go ahead.
In Canada, you know, banks and insurers run their own scenario analyses for different things, right? And they will go to people they trust in order to generate these scenarios. But now the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions in Canada, they're the regulator for all the banks and insurers and pension funds. They want to mandate one standardized scenario analysis for climate that all the financial institutions have to use. And it's based on the really problematic RCP 8.5 scenario. So it's like they take the worst scenario and they're going to mandate that all the financial institutions use this. Right. And I'm thinking, how is that going to be helpful when you're not even allowing competition amongst banks or financial institutions to say, you know what, we can outcompete that guy because we have better analyses. We have better scenarios.
It's going to rig the game. Yeah. Which is, of course, what they always inevitably end up resorting to in any, I mean, we have to go back to the fact that this is all a socialist / communist global movement. And they always end up resorting to rigging the system to push their ideology forward. And because in the real world, the actual results never conform to the projections, right? And so they have to rig the system in order to win. And here we go.
But they can't win if, you know, the actual way things develop and progress is not the same as those models. And that risks whatever tells them.
Yeah.
The reality will get hopefully in the way. But with respect to RCP 8.5, Roger Pilkey has had at least two or three really good Substack posts about it and how it's a disproven, nobody uses it anymore. It's a crazy, unrealistic assumption. And I don't know what weather forecasters use. Good ones would not touch it. The IPCC has said this is so ludicrous, we're not using it anymore. So the IPCC has said that. So, and you can go to their website and they say, we no longer use this. We use RCP 6.5 or whatever. But so they're not, even the IPCC isn't using it, but the central banks use it. So if you have the central bank saying, well, this is the business as usual, which is the absolute worst case scenario, implausible.
Yeah.
And now they're going to mandate all the Canadian financial institutions to use it. I think it's just poor Canada.
And that goes right to the point. Can you trust the data?
Can you trust the data?
No.
I think the answer is pretty clearly no, right?
Not at this point. It's so actively manipulated.
Right. Right. Please go ahead. You've been trying to get in.
I get excited. You guys just have to slap me.
He's been over there.
But, you know, the Biden administration, God bless them. Let's have a moment of silence for them. Okay. So when we sit back and think, oh my goodness, they manipulated the jobs report. The EIA last year finally had a bunch of rumors that they were manipulating the data for oil and gas pricing. Can we even trust the numbers because of our stupidity in political things? So it's not a conspiracy theory when it actually is proven true.
When it's standing in front of you, slapping you in the face, it's no longer a theory, right? Yeah.
Sorry, I get emotional.
Okay, so I think we have a consensus here. The data is not to be trusted.
No data.
So let's go to the headlines.
I'll bring that up, but I just want to share with everybody. I typed in on YouTube in the notes, hashtag COP28, and our feed stopped on YouTube.
Of course.
Why would you do that?
I just wanted to test it. And yes, Google is not trusting the data. Patrick's coming in from LinkedIn. So, you know, guys, yes, we prove it again. Right. Let's go to the news here.
To the headlines.
This would be Irina, I believe.
This is Irina.
Weren't these last week's headlines? I just realized these must be last week's headlines.
Oh, no. Are these not the right headlines?
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry.
I got two new ones. Okay, we won't have them, but I'll just go through them quickly.
Okay. We'll remove this and then go through your new ones. My bad. Technology, you can shoot me later, please.
That's okay. So the first piece of news I wanted to mention was a report from the Wall Street Journal that America's ESG hiring boom is starting to cool. So departures from ESG positions have exceeded arrivals in these positions over the first half of last year. And what I found especially notable is that the most departures happened in big tech and in financial services. My guess is that these were the most active hirers of ESG personnel. And apparently they found out, no doubt with much shock and surprise, that these hires do nothing about their bottom line. So exactly. Now they're letting people go and cutting jobs and trying to rein in costs. It's an amazing development.
It's the ultimate overhead, right?
Well, and plus, can they be replaced by AI, what they're doing?
Probably. Yeah. Oh, wouldn't that be ironic? Try to find a way to share my screen. Anyway, and the other one is really hilarious, but you've probably heard about it. That cancellations threaten Biden's 2030 offshore wind target. Well done. You're almost believable. Yeah, imagine that. Companies are canceling projects because even with the promise of more money, the economies are not working out. So they're pulling out, and this is threatening the agenda. I mean, really, it reminds me of what the UK did when they worried about their carbon prices, that carbon dioxide was so cheap that it threatened the agenda, it threatened the goals. Seriously, people, if it's so cheap, it means there's not so much of it being generated because there's no demand for energy. And that's a problem, suddenly.
Because
you can't meet your
target. No one could have seen it coming, right? I mean, it would have been impossible to see any
of
that.
It's a shocking development. Yeah. Yeah, that was it for me. Yeah.
Patrick, the elite only use data to support their agenda. Well, of course, yes. The goal is to gain total control of all commerce and industry for the express purpose of climate control. Yes, it is. Absolutely.
And Patrick, wealth transfer.
And wealth transfer from you and I to the people who control the data.
wait until they have the natural assets where they can monetize parkland and whatnot.
Yeah.
That one chats my chicken. Sorry. Who's next?
I don't know. What can you show?
I don't know what
the.
We go here.
This
one. That's you, isn't it?
This
is mine.
Okay. Well, go back to Tammy's.
Is that Tammy?
Yeah. Okay. So the first one is mainland China stock exchanges have issued their first guidelines on corporate sustainability disclosure. And that basically means that the really big stock exchanges in China are requiring various ESG data from the companies that are on their stock exchanges. And they're kind of rolling it out the same way that they did in Europe. So the really large corporations will have to comply with the accounting of climate and sustainability. And I think a lot of it has to do with them accessing the new carbon border adjustment mechanism and the various regulations in Europe. So this is a way to try and, I think, defang Europe from putting various tariffs and whatnot on China. They'll say, oh, look, we're accounting for all of these different things that you say, and look, our emissions are really low. And I think Irina and I had a little conversation about this last week when I said, can you trust whatever ESG data comes out of China? Because I'm guessing it's all going to have to run through some sort of, you know, government department, the way some data has to in other oil producing countries. I think in particular Saudi Arabia, anything that's produced there has to go through a ministry before it's released to the public. So is this going to be something similar in China, where the corporations will submit all their information to an authoritative Chinese government department, which will then sign off and say, yes, this is absolutely true. We've got the lowest emissions in the world. You know, we're only using wind and solar to make those EVs and, you know, so on and so forth. So
it'd be like trusting all that COVID-19 data where they kept saying they had zero deaths from COVID-19 throughout 2020 and 21. Anyway.
Super trustworthy data, right?
Yes, super. Absolutely.
And then the second story, which I thought was really fascinating because it came from, I think, Green Biz. And the headline is, does the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission climate rule, really matter? Investors will still demand disclosure. And I can say with some confidence that the investors behind all this, because you're thinking investors such as I own different mutual funds, that's a Canadian one, or in my 401k, I own these different things. Do I, as an investor, care if there's ESG metrics being followed? Not really. But it's the institutional investors. That's right. Who they're talking about. So BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street and whoever else, the big pension funds like CalPERS and the other big ones. So they're the ones who are really pushing all of this. So when they say investors still demand, yes, they absolutely are still demanding. And they're really hoping that if they can get financial institutions like banks to buy into a lot of this stuff and work it in on the ground floor, you wouldn't necessarily need the SEC to do it. Because if California is doing it on their own, and Europe is doing it, and China is doing it, all of these other entities will pull you into it, whether you want to do it or not. And so the argument in that article was that the SEC climate disclosure rule will create a lot of litigation. There's been a lot of pushback, but in the end, it may not matter because everybody else is doing it anyway. And I would say, well, if everyone else is doing it, the big United States corporations aren't, then money's going to go to America where they're not doing it, because it's really expensive. And to do this, the climate and sustainability disclosures. And I honestly don't know how the European companies are going to be able to do it and not go bankrupt.
They're moving to the US.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, lucky us, I guess.
Okay.
That's it. That's all I got for that.
This is the wrong slides for me. So Kind of like Irina, some technical guy kind of like screwed up on that one. Let me get back to this here. Oh, I wonder who that would be. Ah, me. But I did have they lied on plastic producers deceive public about recycling report reveals. Wow.
Another shocker.
Yeah. I was just, I fell over in my chair watching this.
Hard to imagine. So hard to imagine.
And when we sit back and think about it, the industry insiders over the past decade said uneconomical. It cannot be considered a permanent waste solution. It said we cannot go on indefinitely. They focused, and this is about money. In the 50s, the single-use plastics really came in. And so all of a sudden, then they said, oh, we're going to start recycling. I think it's 70%, some huge number of plastics are supposedly, and I use the quotes, recycled, and they're just put into landfills. So all that green buckets that everybody puts into is not recycled.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I mean, I think it's unfair to, like, cause that article seemed to want to demonize the plastics companies for misleading people and so on, but it was really, the governments that were telling them they had to do it. And so they're like, okay, I guess we'll say we're going to recycle these things. But in the end, it would be left to, like in Germany, it's left to the local authorities to do the recycling, not the right. plastic companies. Yeah. And so you can recycle all that stuff and you can turn them into little pellets that can then be shaped into other things, but it's expensive. And yeah, the local and authorities didn't want to pay for it.
Yeah, you have to have in markets for it at the end of the day. And, you know, it's gotta be a large extent, they don't exist.
Can I?
Right. So you could use it like, I know there's an example in Canada where one of the provinces back in the late 80s, early 90s said, there's no way you can recycle milk jugs because, you know, the milk was in these big plastic jugs and there were various things. So like, you can't recycle it and so on. But there was one company that I think they got some subsidy in order to say, yes, we can do it. And they went and they collected all of the milk cartons. They started charging a deposit for it. So they would get the money through deposit. And then they used the plastic pellets from them to make containers for petroleum, you know, like the oil you put in your car. Because, you know, once that plastic, you can't use it for food consumption, but you can use it for other things. And so this small oil company used the milk jugs, plastic recycling for oil for cars.
And oh, my God.
You know, why not? If you want to recycle it, there's a possibility there. It's just how much is it going to cost and are people willing to pay for it?
Let me ask the team this. What about recycling for EV batteries and lithium? Isn't there a huge fire going on in Europe somewhere?
In France.
France. If you haven't just bought the Toulouse.
And how many supposed miles on an EV did this factory just negate?
Oh,
I'm just asking.
Probably Tesla's whole fleet just went up smoke, you know, in terms of any carbon emissions.
Do we know there are actually EV batteries? Because from the reports I read, it didn't specify.
It was unclear. Yeah. It was unclear.
I guess.
And we saw that. I want to point out, though, if you remember the ship that was burning up in the Pacific in November, December timeframe that eventually got to Alaska. The news stories never specified that ship was carrying electric vehicles. But we found out finally at the end that ship was carrying electric vehicles. So it's like our media blacks out that particular aspect of the news to specify that these, you know, so we don't know if these are EV batteries. But they're lithium ion batteries and you know, it's.
Yeah, maybe they're phone batteries.
Maybe so. But the ones that have been spontaneously combusting over and over and over again all over the world in recent years, have invariably, we've discovered, been EV batteries.
Yeah, I don't remember a news story about spontaneously combusting phone batteries.
Yeah, my AAAs in my refrigerator have never spontaneously combusted.
Do you eat your batteries?
Yeah, it extends the battery life if you keep them cold.
Hey, I want to share something from my beloved father-in-law this morning. He had a wreck in his Tesla yesterday, and I'm so sorry, but my brother-in-law was driving it, and he is a left-wing nut job. And so I couldn't be happier that it wasn't me that was driving the Tesla. And so it's going to be insurance companies that are not going to allow for EVs to be on freighters. Ooh. It's also going to be insurance companies, because as soon as one battery is cracked, the entire panel on a Tesla has to be redone. Right. So that's $30,000 on an $80,000 car. When are insurance companies going? Because, Tammy, you'll have to correct me. I believe it was last year sometime they had announcements that insurance was double and going even triple in England. I think I saw your things on that. Anyway, so then my beloved chowderhead brother-in-law, and you know what a anyway, he's, I hope you're watching, you turkey. So anyway, you sit back and kind of go, I think it's the insurance companies that are going to change and stop the EVs. My father-in-law's insurance was doubled.
It costs a lot more to insure an EV. Yeah. And your homeowner's insurance goes up if you have one of the garage chargers due to the risk of spontaneous combustion.
Wait a minute. I just heard my father-in-law spontaneous combusted over the pricing. Sorry. Here comes one from Patrick.
No, I sent that one in.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Because I can't say it's from me. It just says from you. So, so Patrick was asking about who will be monitoring or regulating the world ESG regulations, and it's each nation. So most disclosures are based on the TCFD or ISSB. They claim there's interoperability between all of these different standards, but each nation will come up with their own means of monitoring and regulating.
I'm sure the data they collect will be accurate.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Some are refusing. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So, never mind.
All right. Let's go to the next headlines. Tammy, you still have one more, right?
No, I just had the two.
Okay.
Oh,
who's next?
I had another one, but that's okay. Let me show this one clip with the panel's permission. This guy is an absolute.
If we were talking about climate change the way we talk about a bunch of other very important issues, we'd be doing something about it. And then the thing to do about it really is to vote.
You know, wait a minute. The Obamas talk about it, yet they spend $11 million on a beach house, and they don't seem to be concerned about it raising sea levels. Celebrities and politicians, they preach the same message, but they buy multiple houses, cars, and private jets. They don't seem to be concerned. I mean, the banks, they give out 30 years mortgages on houses that, according to you, will be underwater before they get their money back. So can you make it make sense?
We can do this, people. Thank you.
We can do this.
That is that's Bill Nye, the science guy, everyone, who is actually an engineer.
I love him. I want to get him on the podcast. And he makes so much fun of the World Economic Forum and everybody else. He is.
Yeah, but we can't do that one. This is a family show. That one was full of profanities. I watched it over and over again.
Well, no, but we can have him do it different than David. I mean, so anyway.
Well, I like his deep fakes because, I think it's hilarious that he inserts himself. What great editing he does there. That's really funny. And he was emulating Pierre Poilievre, who's the leader of the Conservative Party in Canada, eating the apple. But he chose the banana instead of the apple.
And I love the ones where he's on The View. I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh. Holy moly. Okay. Next deadlines.
I think we're, are we done?
No, I haven't done mine.
Oh, well.
Okay.
I want to do at least one of mine. That's not that. It's the Rockefeller thing that, you know, you had a video clip for it. There you go. Play that video clip of this weird looking dude talking.
Oh, I already deleted it.
Did you play it? Well, so,
but I,
so that headline.
Yeah.
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it. You don't need to. So the Rockefeller Fund, so this story, I'm sorry, huge story at Fox News this past week about how the Rockefeller Family Fund, which, you know, was established by John D. Rockefeller, by the way, basically the biggest oil man of the 19th century in the United States, is coordinating with the climate lawsuits that attacked ExxonMobil, the whole Exxon New nonsense out of New York State that was taken up by Eric Schneiderman, who was the attorney general in New York at the behest of a bunch of climate change interests, including the Rockefeller Fund, including Michael Bloomberg, including the Gates Foundation. All these billionaires and their foundations are really what's behind all the litigation attacking the oil and gas business in the United States these days.
David, I just put it there to move while you were talking.
Oh, okay. The other aspect of the news that the week before, the previous week, the Wall Street Journal had a big report about how the Rockefeller Family Fund and representatives of it were instrumental in convincing Joe Biden to implement his LNG permitting pause in January. So, you know, a lot of news about the Rockefeller Foundation, and it's no secret. We've known about this for a long time, but it's good to see these major media publications actually catching on to the scam.
Can I add something there?
Yes.
A lot of these big foundations, Rockefeller, Gates, the Hewlett Foundation, Bloomberg, they actually also fund research. They fund research that right. then gets brought into court cases to say, oh, look, right. Exxon New, or oh, look, natural gas kills people with asthma, and all these different kinds of things.
Gas stoves are bad and need to be banned.
Right. And they have various layers of research that's done, and it really permeates throughout the academy. So people think, oh, wow, this is science, and this study says. And sometimes in the acknowledgement, they'll say, with grateful acknowledgement of the funding from Rockefeller or Bloomberg or whoever. And it's like, okay, so then they're not just funding the research, they're then funding the lawyers, they're funding the activist groups, they then have backdoors to the administration, they have people who they funded work in the administration. So it's actually quite a network that
it really
that they
is
use
yeah.
in order to
and
push
it's billions
forward
and billions
agenda.
And billions of dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, Bloomberg alone, his own personal money, it's been well over $2 billion, and his quote foundation is billions more. And, you know, I mean, it's a lot of money.
And the Europeans have a lot of that money too.
Yeah.
And there's the same, these are the same people who first fund the science to come to some certain conclusion and then tell everyone trust the science because it's
right.
science.
Right. If you don't trust them, you don't trust the science. Yeah. They're like Anthony Fauci. They are the science now.
Yeah. And so then it goes back to, can you trust the data? Can you trust the science if it's being funded by these interest groups?
That was why
groups?
I picked that story.
I think a lot of people realized in the years between 2020 and 2022 that you can't trust the science because the science, to begin with, is not an exact science, this particular medicine, healthcare. Remember how the World Health Organization was sending conflicting messages.
Right.
Everybody exactly. forgot that around mid-2021. I didn't.
I got banned from Facebook for pointing it out.
Themselves, but everyone forgot that.
So what happens now that health is supposed to be a climate issue? right? And so now we have the convergence of these two things where you have the climate, whatever, and now we're supposed to be acknowledging the health industry people for providing data and science, whatever, to justify doing further things. So
yeah, I guess we put Anthony Fauci over the climate policy of the United States. That'd be, maybe he should have replaced Kerry.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm going to go throw up.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Well, they have Vanessa Carey, right? They have Vanessa Carey being the climate ambassador for the World Health Organization.
Yeah. So, isn't that incredible? What's her qualification?
She's a doctor.
Oh, is she a doctor of what?
Yeah. I think
suppository medicine. Suppository medicine.
I thought she was she's fairly well known in medical circles. So, okay. I mean, she is a doctor.
Well, good for her. What does she know about the climate?
So is Jill Biden.
Anyway. Okay.
Sorry.
Enough of that. okay. What else do we have? Anything else on the agenda?
Did you have another article there, David?
I don't know. I think I did, but I don't remember what it was.
It was the IEA one, I think.
Oh, well, that
the climate, another climate pivot.
Yeah, that was just the IEA's 50th anniversary thing. We covered that up front. Right?
If there are any listeners, please, we will fix out the technical issues next week for Tammy, for Irina, and David to share live on theirs. If you have questions, I think Patrick had one last comment here. 20% are critical thinkers.
The 80-20 rule.
Yep. Well, you got to combine it with his previous comment, which said 80-20 rule, 80% of the people are sheeple who do whatever the authorities say. I would suggest it's more like 95%. And then 20% are critical thinkers who are most famous for being censored. Yes.
I know what Patrick means.
I like his optimism. 20% is a fifth.
Yeah. Possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Leave it to Irina to be smart.
Excuse me. Well, with that, folks, I think we have beaten this horse to death. The conclusion is we can't trust the data. So where do we go? I don't know.
OPEC. We need a new Substack for data.
Yeah. See you guys next week.
All right, guys.
Have a great week.
Everybody have a great week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.